Rodney, they talk for the silver star. Tonight, the guest, the incredible.
All right, here it is. This week's edition of the Ellison Report, our neighborhood magazine of politics, policy, and the people, presented weekly on your radio dial and podcast link. And we're here at the home of Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm your host and executive producer, Charles D. Ellison, here at the WEAA studios on the campus of Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. Also a head nod to my stellar producers on the Board of Steel, getting it done. Senior producer, Andre Melton, he's on the Board of Steel, and also associate producer, Tyron Rice is also getting it done as well, making sure the trains are running on time for this show, this program. You can also follow me at Ellison Report on Twitter. And don't forget to also listen in whenever you get a chance during the weekdays. I'm also on WURD 900 AM now in Philadelphia, our partner station in Philadelphia, on for a new program called Reality Check. You can join in on the social media conversation there at hashtag Reality Check. Also at 900AMWRD.com if you're here in the Baltimore area, the Baltimore, D.C. corridor, so to speak, and you're sitting down, have nothing to do for about a few hours, and you can listen in Mondays through Thursdays at 4 p.m. on WURD. But in the meantime, we're listening here at WEAA 88.9 FM. I want to talk a little bit about President Trump's foreign policy. What exactly is that? We don't have a clear, coherent picture of the Trump foreign policy just yet. What we do see is essentially the Trump administration reacting to many current events, whether it's Syria or North Korea. Obviously, this week there's been a lot of chatter, emerging chatter about North Korea now and whether or not there could potentially be preemptive military action on the part of the U.S. and its ally, South Korea, as the North Korea nuclear crisis unfolds there in the Asian Pacific. And then also we have other flashpoints to consider, like in Syria, for example, and also looking at tensions brewing in Europe and also particularly in those Baltic states and what the U.S.-Russia relationship is like as well. And then we have the Trump administration unveiling its $1 trillion budget for fiscal year 2018. There are a lot of programs, a lot of budgets with respect to geopolitics and the nation's foreign policy that are on the chopping block. So we want to talk a little bit about that. Joining me to sort of expound on it is Stephen Schottelman. He is an associate professor of political science at the University of Illinois. He joins us by phone, and his colleague, Dustin Tingley, who's also a political science professor at Harvard University. And they recently collaborated on an essay that talks about the question of Trump's foreign policy. Actually, it's entitled Policy Roundtable 1-6, Is Liberal Internationalism Still Alive? And it's in the International Security Studies Forum at issforum.org. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right. Excellent. So I'm going to start with you, Stephen. Is there a Trump foreign policy? Now, you argue in this recent essay that maybe there's not much of a foreign policy, or at least whatever foreign policy there is from the Trump administration, it's not going to change the current trajectory of U.S. diplomacy any more dramatically than it already has.
I think there is at least a set of consistent themes like America First that run through Trump's foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And at least at the start of his administration, there was a lot of debate and discussion, and there still is, about whether that means that we're going to fundamentally change the way U.S. foreign policy works. So in the article that we wrote, along with Helen Milner at Princeton, we just wanted to zoom out and kind of think broadly about what are the big constraints that limit or enable our ability to make massive changes to foreign policy like people thought Trump would do.
Mm-hmm. And Dustin, you're also kind of saying here that the Trump, you know, Stephen's saying that the Trump foreign policy being about America First, but it's always been America First. I mean, any nation state's foreign policy is going to be about that country first. But What strikes you that's somewhat different about the Trump foreign policy message this time around from previous administrations?
Yeah, I think, one thing that's different is the style, the way that they're going about things. So, looking for a huge reset with relations with Russia, I kind of feel like that's in part a way to balance against China. That's novel. Probably not something you would have seen under a Clinton administration quite to the same extent. But also just stylistically, making big claims about the ability to do things, the ability to have a strategy for ISIS in 30 days. We haven't seen anything about that. In North Korea, coming out and saying that preemptive strikes are on the table. I suspect that's more, a negotiating tactic with the Chinese to try to get China to take a more active role in North Korea. Mm-hmm. But those sort of brash, big statements, controversial moves, that is an innovation. But in terms of the actual policies that will come about, I think that, we're going to see a lot of the same status quo. A retreat from international institutions like the UN would be disastrous. It would only be filled by the same actors that, Trump wants to rally against in some ways. So I think we're going to see a lot more of the status quo, but certainly stylistically, the sort of bombastic style, big, bold statements, that's not something that we've seen in the international diplomatic corps for quite some time.
And so, Stephen, we can argue that, there is some sort of diplomatic strategy there. It is, as Dustin says, different, stylistically, but, essentially that strategy is, is chest thumping, is to sort of, go for a more muscular approach to motivate a certain international actors into action. And so that's just sort of the new normal that we're going to have to start getting used to with President Trump.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Another stylistic thing is that the Trump administration seems to be characterized by kind of a question everything approach with foreign policy. So it's whereas previously it would have been unspoken or unthought of to think about withdrawing from NAFTA because we think that the data suggests that we benefit from that. Now everything's fair game. While that was previously infeasible, now that's something that is at least put on the table. And as Dustin said, that's probably often a negotiating tactic, but it's definitely characteristic of the current administration that anything's fair game to talk about.
Mm. Hey, Dustin, you along with Stephen and also your colleague at Princeton University, Helen Milner, talk a lot about liberal internationalism. Describe that a little bit. I know listeners are probably thinking, what exactly does that mean? Does it fit sort of the classic definition of liberalism? What does liberal internationalism mean exactly, particularly in this current context?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, liberal internationalism shouldn't be conflated with, liberals versus conservatives, Democrats versus Republicans. This has nothing to do with that. The liberal international strategy was something that had been pursued by both Republican and Democratic administrations for years. But what it, the way I like to think about it is that it is, it entails a commitment to a set of principles, freedom being one of them, the liberal democracies, trying to promote democracy around the world, and also promoting an open world economy. Mm-hmm. And that's to, go back and say, if one country is better off making one good, let's import it from them and let's export the stuff that we're good at. And that open economic system then, as a result, has lots of advantages for consumers, lower prices, et cetera. And a liberal internationalist policy then is one that's going to really say the U.S. needs to engage internationally. They can't be isolationist. That's something that's been in place for many years. And I think part of what we've seen, not only in the United States but also elsewhere, is the reaction of people that might not have benefited as much as they really should have. And I think, there's something very telling in the failing of some of those policies. Free trade is not been something that has uniformly helped the U.S. citizens. But at the same time, We abandoned programs that were designed to help, you know, trade adjustment assistance, for example. You lose your job because of foreign trade competition, then let's give you money to get educated in a different skill set, et cetera. Those programs were minimally funded and oftentimes blocked. And I think that's in part what has led to some of this, shift away from, support for some of these programs. But overall, you can think about liberal internationalism as a commitment to democracy and open markets, and it really playing a role in collaborating internationally with other countries.
Mm. You know, Stephen, you point out here in your essay that, there had already been a decline in liberal internationalism for some time, and that, and expound on this a little bit, that the Obama administration was kind of like, was struggling with that decline. You know, in some areas it was trying to engage globally or geopolitically, and other areas it sort of felt as if it was kind of drawing itself back from that liberal international order. Talk a little bit about that and maybe how that may have kind of contributed a bit to where we are now as far as America's role in the world.
Yeah. When we were talking about the Obama administration in the essay, we were trying to place them in the context of a big, broader historical debate. And so some people would say the beginning of the end of the United States' commitment to liberal internationalism began with the disaster of the Vietnam War, or others would say that it arose at the end of the Cold War, or others would say that it arose as partisan politics became so entrenched and angry that there would be rapid swings back and forth from one president to the other. And so what we wanted to say was that when we look back at the Obama administration, it wasn't shockingly different in a lot of ways from some of the principles of the Bush administration. It still retained a commitment to international institutions. It still retained a commitment to using force when necessary. Mm-hmm. And it was neither a complete withdrawal nor a wholehearted embrace of liberal internationalism. It was similar in timbre and in practice to what we saw before.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Dustin, talk a little bit, too, about climate change, because you all are arguing that climate change is going to be a big element, a big piece of that conversation on, sort of what's the new world order? Where does the world go from here geopolitically? What the United States' role is in all of that? Climate change could be a big game changer there. Correct, Dustin?
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about the challenges that face not just the United States, but everywhere, a number of them are going to be emanating due to changes in climatic patterns. This can result in immigration. It can result in the spread of disease, poverty, et cetera. And, one of the ways to really see this is the reaction of the U.S. military about climate change. I mean, General Mattis just came out the other day saying, look, from a defense perspective, we think climate change is happening and it's going to be a major issue. Mm. And so, when the U.S. military is coming out and saying that, that's different than, a bunch of scientists. The military is listening to those scientists. I'm not sure the Trump administration is listening to them, but the U.S. military has to, because the U.S. military has to protect the honorable citizens that serve in their ranks and protect our country. I think the other thing that's going to be interesting about climate change for the U.S. is how does the U.S. Respond to that issue economically within the country, right? And so we've already seen Trump, wanting to scale back regulations, wanting to protect the coal industry, wanting to roll back fuel economy standards. But in doing so, the U.S. faces a problem in that other countries are rapidly advancing those technologies. And what's going to happen is that we're just going to get outpaced. Mm. And that the result of that is that, some of these countries might say, look, we won't accept American imports that are being made in these polluting, carbon-intensive type ways, and that's going to be a disadvantage to us. At the same time, I think it's really important, and we talk a little bit about this in the paper, we have to be really conscientious that we're not enacting policies that disenfranchise and put people mm-hmm. out of work that are in industries that were things like coal. Mm-hmm. There's something that I've been calling climate adjustment assistance, right? Mm-hmm. So very similar to trade adjustment assistance, but the difference is that if we're mm-hmm. going to be proactive on climate change type policies,
right.
we have to help these people. It's no fault of someone to be born into an area where coal was the main source of economic livelihood. Mm-hmm. We owe something to those folks.
Right.
And so I think that's an area where, you know, Trump could really, he could actually take a lead on this.
Mm-hmm.
But it remains to be seen if he's willing to do that.
All right. Dustin Tingley, you're going to get the last word. Dustin Tingley, political science professor at Harvard University, also being joined by Stephen Schadowin, who is a political science professor at the University of Illinois. Check out their recent essay, Is Liberal Internationalism Still Alive in the International Security Studies Forum, issforum.org. Stephen is at Stephen Schadowin on Twitter, and Dustin at Dustin Tingley on Twitter as well. Thank you, gentlemen, both. Got to have you back on at some point.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Jazz move.
Take care. Thank you. All right.
Bye.
We're going to be right back. And coming up next is Dr. Maya Rocky Moore on the impending automation invasion here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Prepared for the jumping. If you're 15 or 25, if you're 50 or 75, once you're breathing and you are alive, it's all be whining all day.
All right, we're back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from K-12, a provider of online educational solutions. More at K12.com. Also, don't forget about listeners like you who support efforts like this. Find out more about how you, too, can contribute at WEAA.org. Hint, click on donate. So let's talk about that impending automation revolution. On the horizon is our major rapid technological advancements in automation and artificial intelligence. And the big question mark is, how many jobs will that cost? And answering some of that is the Center for Global Policy Solutions. They just released a new report. It came out this week. It's entitled Stick Shift, Autonomous Vehicles Driving Jobs and the Future of Work. And it's talking about one of those sectors of the economy that we probably take a little bit for granted, and that's the driving occupations. The report claims that about 4.1 million jobs could be lost to self-driving cars. And here to expound on that a little bit more is Dr. Maya Rocky Moore. She's president and CEO of the Center for Global Policy Solutions. Maya, thanks so much for joining us.
Charles, thanks for having me on.
All right. Excellent. So I have to tell you. Oh, go
yeah.
ahead. Please.
I have to tell you that, you know, overall, that, you know, the estimates vary in terms of what this is going to mean for American workers across industries.
Mm-hmm.
One of the higher estimates I've seen is that as much as 47% of U.S. job workers could be displaced by automation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not just in blue-collar jobs, but it's also in white-collar jobs as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Citing that Oxford University study that came out a couple of years ago, and a lot of folks, even in the innovation sector, are really concerned about that. You know, I did want to ask you, there was a hearing about a month ago, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, its Digital and Consumer Protection Subcommittee, had a hearing about self-driving cars, but they didn't talk about the jobs impact. Why is that? Why are policymakers kind of ignoring that aspect of what you're pointing out in Stick Shift?
Okay, so let me just back up and say, in Stick Shift, we find that if there is a rapid transition to autonomous vehicles, that there could be more than 4 million jobs lost here in America.
Mm-hmm.
This is truck drivers, this is bus drivers, this is taxi and chauffeur drivers. And Capitol Hill has not basically been paying any attention to the labor market impact of autonomy, of artificial intelligence and its impact on the U.S. workforce. So the fact that there was a Capitol Hill hearing that the Republicans held, and that it was only focused on safety, suggests to me that they are very much in line with the big players who are seeking to roll out these autonomous vehicles within the next 5 to 10 years. And you know, the tech sector, the folks who are innovating and disrupting in the automated vehicle space are very much focused on the same argument of safety. This is one of their primary arguments for why the nation and the world needs autonomous vehicles. And they want to shift the conversation away from the impact on human beings, human workers. Now, I went out to a Silicon Valley conference a couple of weeks ago, and what's interesting is that I am hearing more policy conversation on the labor market impact and the future of work from non-policy people out in Silicon Valley than I'm hearing here in Washington, D.C., which is stunning, because the people in Washington, D.C. have a responsibility to get ahead of the possible and potential devastation that could come from the advent of autonomous vehicles to the transportation sector, and to put into place and to strengthen our policy framework and our programs that are important for actually making sure that there's not as much human devastation that could result from this as the potential could be. The fact that Republicans in Washington are focused on tearing down the social safety net just when workers are likely to need it most means that there is something else going on here, and I find it quite interesting.
You know, so folks who are members of that, you know, particularly Republican members of that committee, and also many many executives within the automobile industry may argue, well, the creation of this technology might spur job growth. It might create jobs. But that massive displacement that's taking place from the introduction of self-driving cars, that displacement could be very heavy and could create a situation where people are having trouble transitioning from one profession to the next. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, how do you counter that argument that, well, hey, you know, this technology will create jobs. We're going to need people to create the technology. We're also going to probably need people for a while to sit in the driverless cars to make sure that these vehicles don't have accidents. How do you counter that argument?
So when's the last time you walked into your CVS? And you see these rows of self-checkouts, not only your CVS, but also your grocery store. But I want to focus on CVS, because in the CVSs I go to, there are usually about 10 self-checkout lanes, and then about two human beings that are working another checkout lane or two. And then one human being that is making sure that if you encounter any challenges with the self-checkouts, that they're there to help assist you. That means that you've only encountered three frontline workers in a CVS that may have used to have, that prior to the advent of automated technology, probably had perhaps maybe 5 to 10 workers in the front of the house. You're walking into more restaurants in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, New York, where there are fast food carryouts, where you walk in and there are no human beings. You walk in and you're facing a white wall with an iPad where you place your order. And then the order comes out and you have never had any interaction with a human being at all. And then you walk out. And in the back of that, you probably have three workers doing the job of what 20 workers used to do over the entire restaurant. And so what we're seeing here, I think, is something very different than what we've seen in the past. I think what we're seeing here is that the level and the pace at which technology innovation and disruption is happening, and then the efficiency at which these technologies are taking place, because we're talking about artificial intelligence, machine learning from other machines, at a pace that they're saying is actually more rapid than human beings. Artificial intelligence is incredibly efficient, and of course they're saying that they're safer and more accurate than human beings. I think that we're seeing technology innovating at a pace that is more rapid than what we could, than what we can do in terms of job replacement and new job creation. And so I think that we're facing a unique moment in time where you know, our systems that are supposed to promote job creation and opportunities within that are broken. They're broken. Our public education, our higher education, our education systems are not prepared to actually generate enough new workers and people who can innovate, I think, and create new jobs. And certainly our systems are broken in terms of retraining and training, giving people the additional skills that they need to be placed in other jobs. So we're facing, I think, a perfect storm. You know, broken systems, a highly efficient technology, and then, you know, just policymakers who aren't paying attention or don't want to pay attention to what's likely to occur.
You know, one of the more fascinating elements of the report, the Stick Shift report, you go to globalpolicysolutions.org to read that report, is that you break down the impact of the introduction of this technology by state. And so some of the states that are heaviest impacted are states where, frankly, many of those Republican members come from that are currently, you know, sort of in charge of that policy debate on Capitol Hill. In terms of the national capital area where this station reaches, you have about, you know, almost 200,000 driving workers throughout the D.C., Maryland, Virginia corridor that are going to be impacted by the introduction of this, the rapid introduction of this technology. Talk a little bit about that, about, you know, how this, how the introduction of this technology spans across the states.
So the fact of the matter is that the populous states like California, New York, Florida, Texas, they have more drivers because they're more populous. But there are certain states that are going to be disproportionately impacted because they have a disproportionate share of workers who are in driving jobs compared to the other sectors of employment in their states. And these workers earn a driving premium from these jobs, meaning that they earn more from their driving job than they would from non-driving jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, those states include places like Indiana, West Virginia, Arkansas, Mississippi, Iowa, North Dakota, Wyoming, Idaho. These are places that are going to really feel the pain because of the share of workers that they have who are drivers and the amount that these workers actually earn from those jobs. And so these are primarily red states. And what we're really facing here is it's fascinating to see, but it's the Republicans eating their own. This budget that President Trump just introduced is an anti-human, anti-people, anti-red state and blue state, but certainly red state, anti-rural budget. He's cutting out all kinds of programs that are important for rural Americans, the red state voters, people who voted for him. And we continue to see Republicans pushing an agenda, including in terms of this notion of future of work and driverless cars, that will actually harm their own constituents. And they are busy chipping away at the very programs that will be important for actually making sure that there isn't a whole lot of human devastation as a result of job loss due to autonomous technology.
We've got about a couple more minutes left. So, you know, the characterization of what you're arguing, folks may say, okay, well, there's like sort of a phobia of technology here, but it's not a phobia, is it? I mean, it's, you know, people may say, oh, you know, this is kind of like sort of, you know, what you see in science fiction, you know, people fighting back against technology, whether it's in movies like The Matrix, for example. But this is not something, I mean, this is a sensible kind of warning here that you're, you know, trying to make people aware of. This is something we really need to focus on. It's already in motion, this automation, artificial intelligence revolution.
It's in motion, and it's likely not going to stop, and nobody's trying to stop it. We're not Luddites here, but what we're trying to say is this is coming. Not only is it coming, but it's almost here in many instances, and it is here in some. And so why is this stunning that our nation's leaders are not getting out ahead of it, preparing the American people for it, and then making sure that our policy and program systems are strengthened and in place to make sure that people aren't harmed by it? In fact, you know, I would argue that based on the behavior we've seen and the policies we've seen coming out of the new leadership in Washington, they are actually preparing for a nation of basically they're laying the groundwork to ensure that American workers are hurt. And I don't see how that is. I don't see how that turns out into an electoral victory in the future.
All right. All right, talking with Dr. Maya Rocky Moore. She's president and CEO of the Global the Center for Global Policy Solutions. Go to globalpolicysolutions.org for more information. Also at Policy Solutions on Twitter. Check out that new report, Stick Shift, Autonomous Vehicles, Driving Jobs, and the Future of Work. It's a conversation we're going to be having more of here on the Ellison Report. Thanks so much, Dr. Rocky Moore.
Thank you. Take
All
care.
Right, take care. And up next, we're going to be talking with economist William Cunningham, talking about jobs. I want to talk about that latest jobs report and also the rise of interest rates, why you should be concerned, right back here on the Ellison Report. Here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from Island Press. More at islandpress.org and from partners like BE Strategy, Strategy Research Communications. More at strategybe.com. Joining us now is economist Bill Cunningham. He's also founding CEO of Creative Investments. Go to creativeinvest.com for more information. He's joining us by phone. I want to talk about those. I'd like to get into those jobs numbers, or the most recent jobs numbers, Bill, because, you know, obviously the Trump administration, these are the first numbers that have been issued by the Bureau of Labor Statistics for the Trump administration. And I mean, is this really a big kind of victory for the Trump administration? Is this just as much a reflection of Trump administration policies early on as it is of the Obama administration in its final months?
No, it doesn't have anything to do with Trump. It's all Obama. Basically, you know, he had nothing to do with the employment situation in the months leading up to the time that this report covers. So even though it covers, you know, a month during his administration, it's too new. You can't possibly logically, rationally, or reasonably take credit for these numbers. Of course, we know logic, rationality, and reason are absent from the Trump administration, so they'll try to take credit for it anyway. But the bottom line is that, no, they had nothing to do with these numbers, and the numbers are good. It shows a continuing decline in African-American unemployment, something that we had been, as you well know, concerned about in our some of the things we'd written about Janet Yellen being wrong about black unemployment, some of the other talk that had gone on, which was inaccurate. But no, these are good numbers. We'll see how long it trends downward.
And I want to ask you, too. OK, so speaking of black employment, black unemployment, you know, I'm sure you're looking very closely at the president's budget, which he introduced this earlier this week. It's a $1 trillion budget for fiscal year 2018. There's a lot of cuts in federal government programs, a lot of cuts in federal agencies. And, you know, especially when we're talking about the Baltimore DC corridor, there are a lot of black folks who have federal jobs, and I'm sure they're very worried about the extent of these cuts. In fact, I believe like a quarter of the federal workforce is African-American. So what's going to happen there, you think, Bill, with this president's budget? If I'm sure the full budget won't be implemented, but definitely there are going to be cuts. How could that impact black employment?
Well, not only black employment, but overall employment, you know, white, brown, mm-hmm. black. It's a very negative budget. It will have the effect of dramatically reducing government spending and shifting spending to the defense side of the house. Now, the problem is that what his economists will claim is that, oh, no, you know, this won't have any negative multiplier impacts on economic activity in the U.S. because we're still spending money. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the defense impact, the defense, what's called the defense multiplier, defense spending multiplier, impact on the economy is low relative to the type of gains and social impact that you can get from the federal government spending money in other ways to help out vulnerable populations, black people, brown people, you know, whomever. So the issue is that this is a very, very bad approach. And even though, you know, you're correct, the budget will not be enacted as written, the problem is that it sends a signal that this administration really wants to do serious harm to the federal government, the federal government's ability to look out for the social welfare of the population. They're really concerned about the social welfare of a narrow, very small, typically non-minority, typically ultra-high net worth group, a set of individuals under a wacky, erroneous economic theory that if you give all of the money to billionaires, that it will trickle down to other communities in a more effective and efficient way than if the federal government spent money. That is, let me say this again, wrong. And you know it's wrong because of the financial crisis. You know it's wrong because of the dot-com bubble bust crisis. You know it's wrong because of the SNL crisis, you know, going back to the 1980s. So it's just a failed theory that unfortunately has been put forward.
I have to ask, though, Bill. Okay, so, you know, based on that history, I mean, and these are smart people, we assume, you know, because they're making that kind of money. They're able to, you know, buy their way into the, you know, the pantheon of the economic elite. Right. So they're not learning from these lessons. And also, I can't understand why cut so many workers out of the federal workforce. I mean, those are folks who also are consumers. Right. I mean, they buy into the American economy. I mean, they're one of the workers, period, are what drive the economy. Right. I mean, that's 75% of the economy is driven by consumer activity. So if you're cutting jobs, you're cutting consumer activity in effect. And I don't understand. I mean, have they made that connection when they're like actively cutting so many billions of dollars out of the federal economy? Like, how come they don't understand that federal dollars, you know, stimulate the economy?
Yeah, because they're not that smart. The first assumption of question is this one, that because somebody has made $1 billion, that they are somehow smarter than the average bear. It could be because they inherited the money, they got a good leg up, and they didn't do anything stupid, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's different than creating $1 billion out of whole cloth, which most of these guys that you're referring to did not do. You know, they're Koch brothers, for example, you know, at the start of the Obama administration, their fortune was $14 billion each. By the time it ended, they had $49 billion. So much for Obama being negative with respect to business.
Right.
You know, so that's the first thing. The first thing is, no, they're not that smart. They are very well-versed in some very narrow technical areas, but that does not apply broadly across the board in the way that you want it to apply when you're talking about the provision of federal services. That's number one. Number two, you know, and this ties to that overall theory that I talked, the trickle-down theory, they are basically greedy. You know, they are looking out for themselves. And there's a part of economic theory that says that. If everybody is selfish individually, then the broad social welfare will be bigger. That's an insane theory, but it is a clear part of conventional, what's called neoclassical economic theory. And again, it's wrong. I mean, you've got years and years and decades of experience that shows you that is incorrect. So what you have here, you have a bunch of people who are making economic policy for the country with very limited experience, very limited brain width, you know, with breadth of experience that does not give them the information or the skill that they need to effectively manage the affairs of the federal government. They're going on the basis of this theory that, you know, federal government is bad and we should shrink the federal government. When the first thing to keep in mind is that most of these billionaires got their start, profited from federal government programs, you know, be they low-income housing programs, as in the case of Donald Trump, or be they families building refineries for Stalin and Hitler, in the case of some of the other billionaires that are part of this club. So no, it's just erroneous across the board. You have to keep that in mind. They know that they're wrong, but they continue to engage and put forward these false theories because they profit from them personally.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit, I guess for about several more minutes, talking to Bill Cunningham, founder and CEO of Creative Investments. Go to creativeinvest.com for more information. Talk a little bit more, Bill, about these recent interest rate hikes and why we should kind of watch these closely. So folks may not be paying very close attention to it. You know, they may not be thinking that it really impacts them. It's not something that they're going to see right away. But you'd argue that we really do need to pay close attention to this. And why?
Well, I would, because of the long-term impact and, once again, the signaling that this sends about whose interests are really being looked after here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your interest. It's not my interest that is being protected by an interest rate hike, especially when, you know, as I mentioned, unemployment falling in the black community after 8 years, you know, in part the decline in unemployment was so slow because of Republican obstructionism. That's all this was.
Yeah.
If we had a government of patriots on both sides of the aisles, we could have seen much bigger, much more positive economic activity much sooner. But we didn't. We had people who famously said they wanted to make Obama one-term president, and to their credit, they did everything they could to try to make that a reality. It didn't happen, at least with respect to Obama, but they kept trying, and now they've got Trump in the White House.
Mm.
So that's part of the issue. Now, with respect to the Fed is, by the way, the most important economic policy player in Washington, D.C., which makes them the most important in the world. If you really want to understand what's going on with the economy or what's going to happen with the economy, you really need to just watch the Fed. They'll tell you everything that they need to know, that you need to know about the future of economic activity in the U.S. and to some extent globally. That's what I do. I watch the Fed pretty intensely. Now, interest rates are historically at very, very low levels, as we've stated in the past. You know, if you need to get a mortgage loan or you need a credit card or a home equity loan or a car loan, now is the time to get it because rates are historically low. But they are, of course, trending up.
Yeah.
And the Fed has announced that they are going to increase interest rates throughout 2017. So you know, it's important to understand that. Now,
right.
Part of the other issue is rates have been kept low for so long in order to provide a mechanism whereby banks, large banks, could make money.
Got it.
Could profit. So That's also part of what's going on. And again, that doesn't look out for the long-term interest of the community served by these banks. And we know that because all you have to do is look at the behavior of, say, Wells Fargo in targeting black homeowners in Baltimore and in Prince George's County with unfair, unethical subprime loans when a lot of those borrowers would have qualified for lower interest rate types of mortgage vehicles.
Right.
So they're, you know, what they're doing is clear.
Yeah.
And also what the Republican Senate, House, White House want to do to support those institutions is also clear.
And to
tie this all back to the Federal Reserve, you basically have to look to see if they are going to take a stand to protect American consumers.
Got it. And Bill, we got actually ran out of time, though. I'm going to have you back on, though. We got to talk more about that and other issues as well. Bill Cunningham, he is founding CEO of Creative Investments. Go to creativeinvest.com for more information, at Creative Invest on Twitter as well. Hey, Bill, thanks so much, man. We'll have you back.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break, and then coming back on the other side is Barrington Salmon of The Final Call. We're going to talk about the black migrant population during all these travel bans and deportations that are occurring here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9, The Voice of the Community. All right, we're back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from Island Press. More at islandpress.org. Also, the main organization for the Urban Resilience Project. And for partners like BE Strategy, Strategy Research Communications. More at strategybe.com. Joining us now is Barrington Salmon. He is a writer for The Final Call, finalcall.com, for more information and some great insights as well. Barrington, how are you doing, sir?
I am fine, sir. How are you?
All right, great, great. So, want to talk about these recent travel bans and deportations and a lot of the activities that are being carried out by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement arm of the Department of Homeland Security. And so it's been getting fairly bad out there, probably much worse than what we're seeing in the headlines. Normally what we see is how this sort of activity impacts Latino or Hispanic populations, but there's been a lot of heavy activity within black migrant communities, you know, people particularly from the Caribbean and also from Africa as well. And how is it impacting that black migrant population here in the United States?
Well, you know, one of the things that the African black migrants in America are usually overlooked when the media and others are talking about the crackdown on undocumented labor, undocumented immigrants. But there are significant numbers of Africans, folks in the Caribbean, and others of African descent who have been affected by this. There are two executive orders that came out about a month ago that has given the Immigration and Customs Enforcement folks more muscle to sweep up, grab up people and deport them, and that's what's been happening. Some media are carrying stories, but I've been talking to folks in different communities, like in New York and in Miami, and even here in Washington D.C., where ICE officers have been just making, like, putting up checkpoints, stopping motorists on the road, going to areas where the day laborers would congregate, trying to find work. They've been going into schools, they've been going into churches, and any restaurants and businesses wherever immigrants congregate. And usually, I mean, it's very targeted, and it's targeted to people of color. They're not arresting Europeans, who are undocumented. It's primarily Latino and African.
You said that, so they're not. I was real curious about that, and I'm sure a lot of listeners out there are curious about that too, because there are a lot of European migrants that are in the United States that we don't talk about enough, and so that kind of deportation action, it's not happening with European immigrants.
No.
Interesting.
And the thing is that if anyone takes the time to read interviews by Steve Bannon.
Right.
Or to take a look at the history of someone like Jeff Sessions.
Right.
They are violently anti-immigrant. They don't even want legal immigration.
Right.
And one of the things that Bannon has done is that within the next year or the next few months, they're going to lower the amount of regular legal immigration to like 50,000 a year.
Mm.
And if you have checked out Breitbart, which is the neo-Nazi, anti-Semitic, anti-woman, anti-black website that Bannon used to run, they talk about the fact that they want to make the United States an ethno-nation, meaning that it's for whites only. They don't want any black people here.
Mm.
And so they're using the instruments of power and policy to effect these changes.
So that, you know, what sort of impact, Barrington, does that have on, you know, as far as the black migrant situation and limiting or creating such limited access for black diaspora migrants to the United States? What sort of impact will that have on black American communities, particularly in places like the Baltimore, D.C. corridor?
Well, you know, one of the things that we as people of African descent need to do is to do our research, check out for ourselves what the truth of it is, because the narrative that this administration is trumpeting paints all immigrants as being people that just suck welfare, social services, and other programs from this country and give nothing in return, which is a lie. Because immigrants, both quote-unquote legal and undocumented, bring hundreds of billions of dollars into the country. They are the folks working in construction, the folks working in restaurants and other eateries. They're the ones picking fruits and vegetables. They open restaurants. They open businesses, small businesses and otherwise. So they are making positive contributions, even when they're not documented. I mean, most of the folks who are here as undocumented immigrants, they still pay taxes. But if you listen to right-wing politicians and folks in the administration, they would make it seem as if they bring nothing. And, you know, one of the things, I read a report by the Center for American Progress, and they're saying that in the next decade, the U.S. will lose about $434 billion in GDP because of if the U.S. goes ahead and removes most of these undocumented immigrants. So there's going to be significant impact if these guys get the opportunity to follow through.
Interesting. Another thing I did want to talk to you about too, Barrington, is the extent. I know this is kind of veering off subject here for a moment. The president's budget. And we just put out this $1 trillion fiscal year 2018 budget, and there's a lot of cuts in social safety net programs. So, you know, talk to us a little bit about that, about, you know, I know that's something you're going to be looking at over the coming weeks. How bad is that? I mean, how severe are these cuts, particularly in some of these communities that we've been talking about in this segment?
Well, if you there are 80 programs in the government, the federal government, that are slated for cuts. He is, you know, he wants like a 30% cut in the State Department. I think like a 34% cut in EPA, and it's those type of cuts. The cuts to eliminate the meal on wheels for seniors, eliminate education programs. $4 billion he wants to take from Pell Grants. They've gutted a number of educational programs, a number of Head Start programs. They are directing money from public schools to private schools. and to voucher programs. But the you know, as bad as all this sounds, the what Congress decides to do will make a difference.
Mm.
So if Congress grows a backbone, and if they oppose a number of these programs, then they may not get cut. But it's going to depend on Congress, and it's going to depend on people getting out and making as much noise as they can and doing all that they can to indicate to Congress and to the White House that they oppose and won't allow these cuts to happen. But much of it depends on what the congressional Republican leadership and others in Congress are going to do.
Mm.
And there are indications from what I've been hearing and reading that a number of Republicans are saying that they won't allow this to happen. But we'll see. We'll see.
Mm. So
because it's more about power than it is about catering to the needs of regular Americans and ordinary people in this country.
Mm. All right. Talking with Barrington Salmon. He is a writer for Lee Politics, writer for The Final Call. Go to finalcall.com for more information. Hey, Barrington, thanks so much, man. We'll be talking to you again.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right. Take care.
All right. Take care. Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. And that wraps this week's edition of the Ellison Report. All right. I'm your host, Charles Ellison. I want to give another big ups to Andre Melton and Tyron Rice, digital producer Ali Post, and others at WEAA. Touch base at Ellison Report on Twitter. Also continue to listen in at the home of cool jazz and much more, as you can hear, at WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Let's build on it. Let's build a Cadillac with grill front end. What the?